Good morning. Illinois Appellate Court, First District Court is now in session. The Fourth Division, the Honorable Justice Mary K. Rochford presiding, case number 22-1568, Jason Hill versus DePaul University.
Good morning, everyone. I am Mary K. Rochford, and I, along with Justice Hoffman and Justice Martin, we will be hearing the oral arguments in this case today. We would like to give the opportunity for each side to present their arguments. They will have a 20-minute time period, and then the appellant will have 5 minutes in reply. May we hear who is going to be arguing for the appellant, please?
Good morning, Your Honor. Gianna Scatchell-Bazilli for Jason Hill.
And who will be arguing for the appellate?
Good morning, Your Honor. Rachel Bossard on behalf of the appellate.
Okay, the appellant may begin, please.
Good morning, and may it please the court. May reserve time for a rebuttal.
You will have 20 minutes now and 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors, today we stand here at a crossroads where the values of academic freedom, freedom of speech, and protection against discrimination intersect along with one of the most contentious issues of our time, the Israel-Palestine conflict. Jason Hill, a distinguished professor at DePaul University.
You know, I'm sorry. I'm sorry to interrupt you. The panel had asked that I notify the parties that we are really familiar with the facts of the case. What we really wish to hear today is that the attorneys go through each count and talk about the elements and the legal issues involved. So thank
you. Absolutely,
Your
Honor.
Sorry to not have said that at the beginning.
No problem. All right. We are appealing counts 1 through 4, which were dismissed with prejudice under a 2615 motion to dismiss standard. A motion to dismiss under 2615 is a so what motion. In ruling on a 2615 motion, the court accepts all well-pled allegations and the pleadings are liberally construed and all reasonable inferences are resolved in the plaintiff's favor. Here the first count that we appeal is the defamation per se count, which is count 2.
What happened to count 1?
I was going to go to count 1. Actually, you're right. Let's start with count 1, which is the breach of contract. Regarding the breach of contract, we have a faculty resolution that was passed by one of, and spearheaded by Scott Pace, which is one of the defendants in this case. This was an unprecedented action that occurred. It did not follow any of the protocol that was required as set forth in the faculty council guidelines. Specifically, we have the section 4.4, which outlines the disciplinary matters and how they're supposed to be handled. It sets out the procedure. Go ahead.
Can I ask you a question? Mm-hmm. Is censorship discipline?
Here it is, Your Honor, because right now we have a situation where there's supposed to be academic freedom and creative expression. And we have a professor who's a professor of philosophy, where he's supposed to challenge and search out truth and have that creativity to be able to do so.
But my question is it discipline? I mean, certainly it's a statement by the faculty council that they take issue with the opinions in this article and very strongly take issue. But is censorship discipline?
Well, right now, when you have to look at it, Your Honor, respectfully, I'm going to ask you to not piecemeal and say that it's just censorship as discipline, because right now, when you look at the aggregate effect of this resolution caused, we have
his
class is being boycotted.
That's the result. But my question is a discipline, because almost all of the sections that you talk about are disciplinary provisions. major infractions, major separation, demotion, loss of censorship. But your AAUP guideline speaks of censorship and discipline in the disjunctive, not in the conjunctive. So it would appear that your AAUP guideline that you rely on does not consider censorship to be discipline. And if censorship's not discipline, then every other section that you claim is breached really has no relevance because he wasn't suspended. He didn't lose his wages. He wasn't suspended and he didn't lose his tenure. So I suppose we're back to the question of is censorship discipline, and if so, why? I think you're frozen, Ms. Basil. Now you're unfrozen. Go ahead.
Okay, could you hear me okay?
No, you were frozen. Okay. We didn't hear you.
Am I frozen right now?
No, you're. No. We hear you now.
Okay, great. Okay, great. Respectfully, it doesn't have to be necessarily a disciplinary action. It shows a strong disapproval by his colleagues, and it is step one in a two-step process to have him removed his tenure. It's also a material adverse action which altered the terms and conditions of his employment. He didn't have to lose tenure, right, to be considered an adverse action and a form of discipline, especially when you're in an academic or professional context. When an institution is censoring individual speech, it's often implying, or here they outright said, we condemn his speech to the strongest degree. And then it operated also as a prior restraint where it gave him a beware, buyer beware. If you continue to make these articles and write these articles that we feel takes a position adverse from ours, there will be consequences. And then they alluded and added to different sections of the AAUP, which is incorporated by reference.
Okay, what are his damages?
His damages here are that he has had loss of opportunity for wages. It's impacted his professional standing, his teaching opportunities. He's had classes canceled. He's been has not taught an upper level course since this has happened. And we're talking about somebody in the College of Philosophy who is mostly teaching graduate students, or was before this article came out. And it stunted his professional growth as a professor. Moreover, he's also lost opportunities to have the different speaking engagements and writing engagements that he's had for years that all of a sudden suddenly dried up. Even worse than that, he's been subjected to death threats. He had to have campus security for at least 2 weeks. It was not safe for him to be in the workplace. He's considered a pariah. They had a censorship dinner celebrating the censorship that they considered to be non-actionable.
So, counsel, let me interrupt you for just a moment when you're speaking about some of the adverse consequences. And you've pointed out how those adverse consequences flowed from what DePaul did and not perhaps from the article itself. How is it that you attribute that to DePaul? How, and tell me how you allege that, just that it's a consequence of what the university did, and not a consequence of the article itself.
Well, I think when you look to the facts of what flowed from what happened after the article, you have a major escalation of what occurred. There was the leak to the DePaulia paper of this draft resolution. You have the from Professor Provost Dunham condemning and criticizing Jason Hill and touting that, you know, these protests and boycotts, she was proud of students for doing so. The unique targeting among the faculty. The provost is almost up there with the president of the school, and she's sitting there saying, he was wrong. This was bad. What you did was good. It was encouragement.
Can we stick to count one, however? If you're talking about breach of contract, and it appears to be a breach of, primarily a breach of the of procedure in the handbook, what damages flowed if we accept that there was a breach of procedures that resulted in the resolution? What kind, what damages flow from that? I think you're frozen again.
Now we lost her completely.
I'm here, Your Honor. I apologize. I couldn't hear what you had said.
I'm just saying, let's stick with count one for a moment on damages. What you just discussed seemed to flow from some of the other counts. What damages flowed from a breach of contract, which appear to be primarily a failure to follow procedures?
Yes, absolutely. And I apologize. I thought
you want. You're frozen again. We can't hear you.
I didn't tailor me.
You know, maybe we should take a few minutes and let you
from people.
We cannot hear you, so maybe we'll take a few minutes and have you see if you can get your internet or whatever the issue is.
These other activities that he was paid for also.
Basil, we're unable to hear you. Perhaps Justice Rochford suggests perhaps you should sign in again or see if there's something else you can do to boost your internet, because you're breaking up and it's difficult for us to hear you.
Absolutely. I'll sign in. I'll sign back. I'll be right back. Can you hear me better now?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm just going to start, if you don't mind, from the beginning. I'm not sure what you guys heard and what you guys didn't. So hopefully this will be much better. So in terms of his actual damages that flowed from the breach of contract, we have the professional impact. Those would be the diminished prospect for future earnings outside of the Paul. We have the stunted opportunities for the professional advancement, both within DePaul and outside of DePaul. We have the loss of speaking engagements and extracurricular pay. We have the lost opportunity for promotion and wage increases. As for the teaching opportunities, we have the cancellation of three of his summer and fall 2019 classes. We have reduced class sizes for the remaining courses that he's taught, and he has not taught an upper level course since all these actions by DePaul occurred. As for the reputation, or actually, I'm not going to go there because it's only for the breach of contract. So those are the two that we'll focus on, the professional impact and the teaching opportunities.
Could I ask a question? Is his pay been cut? Has he lost pay?
He has not lost pay from DePaul's salary, but okay. He's lost pay.
Has he been demoted at DePaul? He's still a tenured full professor. Is that correct?
He's still a tenured full professor, but the amount of courses that he's teaching, the type of courses that he's teaching, and just the terms of his employment have been significantly altered.
He's not been suspended from his job.
Correct.
Is that correct? And he certainly hasn't been fired.
That's correct.
So why aren't these future damages that you're claiming purely speculative? We don't know how much you will earn, and there's no way to prove it.
Well, in the past, he had multiple different speaking engagements that he had routinely had, and he had the possibility and expectation that those would continue in
certainly,
the past
certainly,
or in the future.
Certainly, that's an argument as to interference with prospective advantage. But my question is, as to a breach of contract claim, you have to prove actual damages now, and you don't allege any. I mean, all of this things that occurs to me that you're alleging are speculative in nature, and damages in a breach of contract have to be, the damages themselves have to be spread with specificity so that it can be calculated. How would you calculate how much he lost from speaking engagement? Really, because how much he made in the past?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. You know, I should comment very, very quickly, whoever drafted this complaint. Our Code of Civil Procedure requires a specific prayer for relief after each count. There is no specific prayer for relief after each count in the third amended complaint. There appears to be one huge claim for damages after the last count. But Section 2-604 of our code requires a specific claim of damages prayer after each count in the complaint. It's not there. Go ahead.
Your Honor, and just to clarify for a moment, I want to make sure that it's on the record that that was not Mr. Cooper or myself that drafted the third amended complaint. We inherited what was left, and at this point in time, we are hoping to be able to move forward and address some of those issues that are within the third amended complaint. I'm going to go back to what you had said about the damages. When you look at the cumulative effect here, you have the speaking engagements, which the school was very well aware of, that he had these various different engagements. Each one of them have a specific monetary amount attached to them. The extracurricular activities also have a monetary amount attached to them. When you have very low enrollment in courses, what flows from that is that the courses get canceled. And when you have a professor that isn't providing the classes that people want to take and the demand, now he's rendered obsolete. And while you might say that they're speculative, the things that we already know concretely have happened as of this date: courses were canceled, he lost extracurricular activity, he lost the speaking engagements and writing engagements, and he was also given a prior restraint on his speech by saying, we're warning you, don't do this again or else. And now there's the threat that he potentially would lose.
I'm going to ask you to comment on a phrase from the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. Where a censured employee retains his job and does not suffer any loss of pay or rank, any alleged harm to his stature or earning prospects is purely speculative.
What I want to emphasize here is that this is, we're at the pleading stages, the very early stages of the case. We hadn't taken any discovery at that point, and it's really hard for us to now pinpoint what those specific damages were beyond speculation or concreteness without having the benefit of discovery and without having the benefit of really investigating those facts and seeing how this has played out. Because remember, we haven't even gotten through the pleading stage at the point of now where we're at with this appeal.
Okay, go ahead.
As we reiterated in our brief, we had made very much mention on there are specific guidelines and disciplinary matters that must be followed. And the allegations that were made were step one of step two, removing him for tenure. Now let's focus on the count two, which is defamation. The defamation claims that we've mentioned in the Third Amendment complaint are as follows. They fall into a few different categories, which are statements that were made in the Faculty Council resolution, statements that were made during the Faculty Council meeting, and statements that were in Dr. Ghanem's email. In the interest of time, I'm going to just briefly mention what these statements are. That he committed an abuse of academic freedom by not exercising adequate concern for accuracy, restraint, or respect for the opinions of others as per the AAUP guidelines. Dr. Hill expresses positions that are factually inaccurate, advocate war crimes, ethnic cleansing, and give a voice to racism. His actions give grave doubts on the fitness for his position. He committed an abuse of academic freedom. His op-ed was factually inaccurate. He distorts facts, promotes racism, advocates for war crimes and ethnic cleansing, and he gives a voice to racism. He also uses his right to academic freedom and free speech to disparage another group over another. The trial court here stated that Jason Hill was a public figure. As we stated it and outlined in our brief and provided much precedent for, he was not a public figure. And at that point, that's something for summary judgment. And again, as I stated before, we are merely at the pleading stages, where all facts that are alleged are not only the light most favorable to the plaintiff, but also taken as
correct.
True.
The facts that are alleged are taken as true. But the conclusions that you draw from those facts are not taken as true. So the question becomes, are any of these statements defamatory? Or are they merely expressions of opinion on the part of the writer?
Well, I think the thing that you have to really look at, Your Honor, here is that when you draft a faculty resolution, the resolution isn't based on opinion. It's based on verifiable facts.
Is it verifiable if you call someone a racist or espousing racist opinions?
When you include additional facts that imply some sort of specific instance or state that there was a prior instance or a history, as we stated in the Overhill case, yes, it is. This wasn't just the general statement that, you know, he was a racist. This reminds me a lot of the case where I think it was Bradley, where it was, she was a slut. It didn't specifically state how she was a slut, but it gave other context of there was the two guys that she was with and provided those kind of context. Here, this was the same thing. He gives a voice to racism. In addition to that, the next step is he advocates for war crimes and ethnic cleansing. We condemn his actual article that was written about the Palestine-Israel conflict. This provides specific concrete incidents where you could actually verify those facts and see whether or not.
How would you verify that? How could anyone ever verify that?
By what, being a racist or advocating for ethnic cleansing?
I mean, that he espouses racist views. How do you verify whether he did or didn't? Other than to say one man has an opinion that he did. And he has an opinion that he didn't.
Well, here it was more than just one opinion. It was the aggregate as the faculty council. It was also, you have to look at the main crux of the defamation cases are not piecemeal or to isolate the statements, but to look at them as a whole and also look at what the writer intended to convey and what the reader perceived that to be. And I think the DePaulia article, where it says that he's condemned by the faculty council for being factually inaccurate, I think that that all really shows how it was perceived by the general public. No matter how you look at it, it's defamation. It wasn't some sort of abstract statement that, oh, he's just a racist, that guy. No, it was, he's a racist who advocates for ethnic cleansing, genocide, all of the above. Those are all things that provide specific concrete examples of how it goes one step further than just making a statement out of thin air. And also, as stated before, the AAUP requires a factually verifiable statement. So on one hand, they're saying that they're conceding to Paul by saying this was a resolution that we drafted and it was a verifiable fact. And that's what they intended it to be.
The AAUP also suggests that when he publishes it, he does it as a private citizen, not as a member of the faculty of DePaul.
I saw that in the briefing.
If you look at his article, he never says in there, these are my opinions. At the end of it, he says, my name is so-and-so, and I'm a professor at DePaul, and I'm in the philosophy department. So, you know, when you talk about the AAUP requirements of freedom, there's a little problem here with the article itself.
Your Honor, I think the problem, I agree with what you're saying the AAUP states, but I think that it's a red herring because that was brought up in the brief of DePaul, and what DePaul had stated was that wasn't brought up, but that wasn't in the court order, and that also is outside of the face of the pleading.
Hold on. You have to understand, the review of a dismissal under 2615 is a de novo review. We don't care what the trial court reasoned. We only care about the trial court's result and whether it was error to conclude to issue the judgment he issued. What the trial court reasoned is not a concern of ours. The result of the trial court is our concern.
Your Honor, respectfully, I agree with that, but de novo also doesn't allow us to bring in new arguments and new material into the appellate argument or record.
Well, the appellee can argue anything in support of the judgment below that's borne out by these pleadings. The big question in this case is on the defamation case. Is the faculty resolution nothing more than the expression of an opinion? And if it's an expression of an opinion, then it's not action. But if it's if it alleges verifiable facts that can be proven true or false, then in that particular case, it may rise to the level of defamation. So now the question becomes, these allegations that you make, the defamatory statements, plaintiff abused academic freedom, his article's inaccurate, distorts facts, promotes racism, advocates war crimes and ethnic cleansing, and gives rise to racism. Are those opinions or are those verifiable factual statements where one could verify whether they're true?
Well, let's just look at the distorts facts statement or the factually inaccurate statement. As a professor, they're required to fact check. They're required to make sure that they're accurate in what they write. They can't, you know, just take a position and make up stories about it. They're calling him a liar. They're calling him a shoddy researcher. That's actually what was stated in the DePaulia article, which is how it was perceived by the readers. So yes, absolutely, those are defamatory because you have them saying that we are distorting facts, or Jason Hill distorts facts lies and then passes it off as being a professor. It reminds me of the case, and I could analogize it with the Little League case, which was, I believe, the Green case, where they, you know, in that case, actually it's different because in that case they said, oh, he was a Little League coach, and we only relegated that public figure status to him being a Little League coach. And, you know, in that case, they found that it wasn't defamatory simply because not only did they say, okay, yes, maybe we told him, you know, he couldn't be a coach anymore, but the bigger issue was that he still could help out in any way possible on those other issues, like, you know, for his own child's team, stuff like that. So here we have a situation where we have not that happening, where he promotes racism, but also distorts facts, lies, does shoddy research, and is a bad example for other students. It's essentially the crux of what the argument was. He's a genocide supporter. Those are all verifiable facts. They're not some sort of abstract concept that you can't definitively say whether or not that person advocates, and especially in the position of him being a professor, where he's held to the standard of being a role model, and even more so, let's not even talk about the fact that
Ms. Basil, let me interrupt you. The part of the problem I'm seeing here is that you're sort of taking this out of context. This was an op-ed, an opinion editorial. So what the good doctor was doing was expressing his opinion in an editorial setting. Although he's a professor, it wasn't in the guise of some academic publication. This was an opinion editorial. And like any opinion editorial, it invites the reader to form their own opinion. That's what an opinion editorial does. It is the author's opinion, and it's an editorial, and they're editorializing, as it were. So it seems to me, when you talk about what's verifiable and what isn't verifiable, and that the professor was doing this not as the although as Justice Hoffman points out, he concludes that he's a professor at DePaul. Nonetheless, this was him acting privately, not as a professor from DePaul. He is writing an opinion editorial. And so I think we, in your discussion, we have to keep that in context.
Your Honor, I think you hit the nail on the head with this case in a much more eloquent way that I've said. The bottom line here is that Jason Hill wrote an op-ed piece. He was entitled to his position. What DePaul did was not something that was providing their opinion. It wasn't like they wrote a comment underneath the article and said, this is how we feel about it. We condemn this. We think this is wrong. No, they wrote a faculty resolution that was passed that is required pursuant to both the faculty council, the faculty council manual, and the AAUP to be a verifiably factual statement. They can't include opinion. So Professor Hill's op-ed was an opinion, but the faculty resolution was not. The statements that were made in the faculty resolution meeting were not.
The faculty resolution was not passed in the context of a disciplinary proceeding. If you read the faculty resolution, it reads to me like an answer to Professor Hill's article saying, you know, this, we don't agree with this, and we don't agree with this for the following reasons, and we condemn it because it advocates racism, it advocates genocide, or whatever else you allege. Recent article by Professor Hill, Morrow case, one misrepresented the history of the Israeli-Palestine conflict, distorts the facts about the current state of relations, promotes racism towards Arabs generally and Palestinians particularly, and advocates for war crimes and ethnic cleansing against the Palestinian population. That's what they said. And then they went on in the next paragraph saying, you know, we certainly agree that the professor has the right to publish and express his opinions consistent with the faculty manual and guiding principles of speech or expression. They just say that the article failed to exercise adequate concern for accuracy, restraint, or respect for the opinions of others. The article represents an abuse of academic freedom, condemns both the tone and content of it. That's what the resolution says.
Your Honor, but respectfully, even if the faculty resolution wasn't something that was disciplinary in nature, regardless of anything, it was published. It was published not only to all of his peers, but also to the campus-wide through DePaulia and to the public at large, because the DePaulia is a public syndication. So it doesn't matter whether or not it was a disciplinary punitive measure. It matters that it was published, and here it was. On top of that, you have Selma Ghanem, the provost, email sent out to the whole entire student body of the largest Catholic university in the United States.
Okay, I understand what you're arguing.
And further, I hope I didn't interrupt you, but if I could further state that this was an ad hominem attack against Jason Hill personally. His research is shoddy. He's a supporter of genocide. It wasn't that his article is a supporter of genocide. No, it was saying that he supports that. He supports ethnic cleansing. He gives a voice to racism. It was about him personally, an attack on him, not the article and the content within the article. This resolution was on a point-by-point rebuttal of his op-ed piece. It was an attack against him personally, Jason Hill, the individual, the professor at DePaul University, the one who they stated his actions raise grave doubts concerning his fitness for his position. If that's not the quintessential defamation per se, I don't know what is.
Well,
because it prejudices him and his position.
I only want to correct you because I'm reading from the resolution right now where it says, the recent article published by Jason Hill, one, misrepresents, two, suggests. This is a criticism of the article, not of Jason Hill. Not until you get to, I suppose, the condemnation of the opinions contained therein. The article failed to exercise adequate concern for accuracy, restraint, etc. The tone and content of the article. The resolution is directly against the article itself and the opinions contained therein. So I suppose I'm back to my other question. Why isn't the resolution nothing more than an expression of opinion?
Well, as I stated, that there's three different types of defamatory statements that I categorized into three different sections. The faculty resolution is only one of those three. You have the email from Selma Ghanem, which we allege is a separate action of defamation based on him, abusing his academic freedom. And then you have the other statement, the statements that were made during the passage of the faculty resolution. The faculty resolution language was influenced by what was said during that faculty resolution meeting. And there was a censure that was never done before to any other professor at any other time in DePaul University's history.
That may be your human rights violation action, but it's not your defamation action.
Your Honor, respectfully, I disagree, because it's anything that's going to put him into disrepute or denigrate him in the eyes of his peers or the public. And getting a public censure is worse than a slap on the wrist, especially when you're in academia.
Well, the censure itself is not defamatory. It's the content of the resolution or what was said about him is the defamatory material, not the fact that it resulted in a censure or a condemnation.
The resolution was intended to and did result in problems for Jason, Dr. Hill personally. It did not result in the publication of his article or as a rebuttal to the article. Here we have what was put into the resolution as a prior restraint in the future for his speech, but also in the past by calling him a liar and saying that it was factually inadequate and everything else, because obviously it wasn't just the article itself. It was the person that drafted the article that was factually inaccurate, that failed to fact check, that lied.
You have gone over, I don't know if you want to touch upon the other counts that you have not discussed yet.
Yes, if that's okay, Your Honor, if I could just have a few minutes on that.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Count three, we allege tortious interference with prospective advantage against all defendants. Now, as we had alluded to during some of the different parts of this argument, there was a significant damage that occurred to him, and there was an interference with the prospective economic advantage. That included not only his ability for future engagements that were suddenly dried up, his extracurricular activity within DePaul itself, and the argument that there was a reasonable expectation of entering into these valid business relationships flow from a couple things. One, that he had these in the past. They were publicly available for the general public. Two, the defendant knew about these different engagements as alleged in our complaint. And three, this was an intentional, unjustified interference by the defendants because they had never before done a censor, public censure on another professor at any other time. There was other professors that had.
Can DePaul University ever be liable for tortious interference with Professor Hill's relationship with DePaul itself?
Not with DePaul itself.
But you do allege
that. With the other speaking.
You do allege it. There's a difference between his claims of interference with promotion, et cetera, and so on at DePaul, and his claims of interference with prospective advantage with third parties. My question is, can you ever sustain a cause of action against an employer for tortious interference with its own employment contract?
Well, that would fall under the tortious interference with the contract itself of the employer, which would be DePaul.
An employer cannot be liable for tortious interference with prospective advantage as it relates to the employer itself. I mean, it just isn't. I mean, the cases are legion. It just cannot be. But my next question is, what about the employees? Can the employees be found guilty or liable for tortious interference with the employee's contractual rights or prospective advantage with the employer itself? Can the employees be held liable?
Your Honor, I'm going to answer your question is twofold, so I want to make sure I answer each one. So with respect to the first one, whether or not an employer could be liable for a prospective advantage within itself, I agree with you. There are lots of precedent that flow from that. But here we have a situation where we're only at the pleading stage. So all we have to do is argue or provide some sort of entitlement to relief, even if it wasn't something that we specifically alleged within our complaint. And we argue that, you know, again, as we stated, we did not draft the third amended complaint. Had we drafted it, we would have had a claim in there for the tortious interference with contract, as well as the tortious interference with prospective contract. Now on to your second claim that you had stated about
let me understand something. Mm-hmm. Are you saying that an individual could be found guilty with of tortious interference with a contract that individual entered into?
No, I'm talking about the institution
contract, but certainly not interference.
I'm talking about the employer itself.
Yes.
And with current tortious interference with current contract, not prospective.
Well, I mean, tortious interference with a current contract? I mean, the breach of contract, maybe, but tortious interference with your own contract? I have tortiously interfered with a contract that I'm a party to?
Well, I think here you have college professors, which are in a unique position. I understand what you're saying here, but he's a professor, and right now where once they receive a tenure, it's a little bit different than a traditional contract law. But on to the second point that you had stated about the employees and whether or not they could be potentially liable, I think that at this stage, only at the pleading stages where we have not had the benefit of discovery, we do not yet know if they were acting in their personal capacity, but they could be potentially liable.
Don't you have to allege it? Don't you have to allege that they were acting as individuals and not as agents of DePaul? Of course, you don't want to allege that for count one, do you?
Well, that would be correct. But I think that what is represented, this is a very unsettled area regarding the specific employees and whether or not they were acting in their professional capacity, personal capacity, and without the benefit of discovery, we don't know that. All we have is what we alleged in the third amended complaint. And what we alleged in the third amended complaint was that specific steps were taken that were by two individuals, Scott Pace, Sal Maganum, and the institution as a whole. And as a result of that, we are entitled to at least to have that in the light most favorable to us. And this was a dismissal with prejudice, meaning that we can't even go back and amend the complaint. And that's what we're trying to do here. We're just trying to get a remand back to state court to properly allege and clean up the third amended complaint, which we didn't have any party to at that time.
Isn't the problem that the plaintiff was given opportunities to amend his complaint when the prior complaints were dismissed? We're on the third or fourth complaint now. And so how many times do you get to amend it?
Well, pleadings are liberally construed and the amendments should be given, you know, to promote justice and in the interest of promoting that justice. And here it's clear that there's a lot more that meets the surface of the complaint. I think that you guys have raised some great questions as to, you know, where are certain things defamatory, are certain things are certain people subject to the contract. But right now we have to remember that we hadn't even got past the pleading phase. We hadn't taken any discovery. We don't have that benefit of knowing what we would know in hindsight if this was a motion for summary judgment, which it's not.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. And then finally, as to the last count, which is the Illinois Human Rights count, let me briefly speak about that one. Jason Hill is a dark-complected, homosexual man from the Caribbean. He is in the College of Philosophy, which is surrounded by white peers where nobody is of his descent and nobody is homosexual, at least not at the time in question. He alleges that he was racially discriminated by DePaul as an African-American because he was expected to adhere to a certain opinion that African-Americans had ancestors who were slaves, and they should in fact view the Palestinians as being enslaved, as an enslaved race, and the Israeli government as a slave regime simply because of the color of his skin and where he comes from. What we have to support this is that several other professors had taken very extreme positions or controversial positions, generating statements that have been the subject of actions of the Israeli government concerning Palestinian residents of the territories of the West Bank and Gaza, and they were never subjected to a public censure. They were never had emails written about them saying that, you know, we condemn his actions, he abused his academic freedom. None of those people were doing that, and none of those people were of Caribbean or African descent or homosexual. And for these reasons, we state that what flowed next was that there was material alterations of his employment conditions. As we touched on before, he wasn't able to teach his extracurricular. He has not taught an upper level course since this article. He had a public censure that was an unprecedented move. He's considered a pariah. His peers won't even speak with him. They had a censorship dinner to celebrate this. DePaul gave the student body one whole building to distribute paraphernalia and boycott and advocate for the quote unquote dumping of Jason Hill. He had death threats against him. The death threats weren't investigated by DePaul. They didn't do anything about it. The only thing that he got was campus security, which, you know, had been extended for at least 2 weeks at that point. Yet we have no answers on who did that, who was making the death threats, what actually happened to them, was there any investigation at all? And those are all questions, I think, for discovery and why we should be given remand to at least replead this complaint and give this case the best shot to do the most substantial justice between the parties and for Jason Hill in particular. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. If the appellee would like to proceed, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Isaac Newton's third law of motion states, for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. We're here today because Dr. Hill published a provocative and controversial article, knowing full well that it would prompt a response from the university community. He didn't like the response. And now he's blaming the university, the provost, and the president of faculty council for the fallout. I could quote various provisions of the article. I know you've read the article, but statements like, not all cultures are indeed equal. Some are abysmally inferior and regressive. And going on to state, Palestinians constitute a national security threat to Israel, and therefore only a policy of radical containment or expulsion remains a viable option. These are just some of the statements published in that article by Jason Hill that I know you've read. And I'm going to go through each of the counts as you have requested, but I'd like to make a few points that I think are germane to each of the counts. Plaintiff's allegations in the Third Amended complaint are insufficient to hold DePaul University liable for any of the actions of its students or its faculty in response to their disagreement of Jason Hill's article. At no time did any member of DePaul University administration ever use the term censure. That term does not appear anywhere in the DePaul faculty handbook and is not a mechanism for taking any action against a faculty member. It simply doesn't exist at DePaul University. Dr. Hill was never disciplined in any way, shape, or form by DePaul. And 5 years later, Dr. Hill remains a full-time, tenured, full professor at DePaul, continuing to publish controversial statements, garnering complaints from the DePaul community. And finally, Dr. Hill has not pled any damages as a result from any actions taken by DePaul, Dr. Pate, or Dr. Gotham. Despite having several opportunities, Dr. Hill failed to state a claim upon which relief could be granted. First of all, he failed to plausibly allege that DePaul breached any contractual obligation to him or that he suffered any damages as a result. Second, the alleged defamatory statements are subject to the innocent construction rule and are non-actionable opinion. Third, Jason Hill failed to plausibly allege that defendants induced any third parties to terminate their relationship with him, causing him any damages whatsoever. And finally, Jason Hill failed to plead that he suffered any adverse action in order to state a discrimination claim under the Illinois Human Rights Act. The terms and conditions of his employment have not changed. Now I will turn to the first count of the complaint, which was the breach of contract against DePaul. We have difficulty understanding at times what the Third Amended complaint alleges, but as best we can understand it, there are three alleged breaches of the contract. And the first is an allegation that Dr. Hill's academic freedom was violated, which is guaranteed by Chapter 6.1 of the Faculty Handbook. And I would like to note that 6.1 of the Faculty Handbook states that not only the faculty, but also the students and other members of the university community enjoy academic freedom. as they participate in various forms of open inquiry and debate. Now, both the Faculty Council's resolution and Provost Ghanem's statements specifically and without question affirmed Dr. Hill's right to express his opinions. The resolution doesn't even mention the word censure or discipline. And as the lower court correctly pointed out, there's no contractual obligation that defendants refrain from discussing or criticizing plaintiff's opinions. Even if this court believed that Faculty Council's resolution somehow infringed upon Dr. Hill's academic freedom, he failed to allege that DePaul sufficiently controlled the actions of Faculty Council such that DePaul would be liable for their passing the resolution. Now, agency requires allegations that DePaul controlled or had the right to control Faculty Council, that Faculty Council consented to act on behalf of DePaul, and that Faculty Council did in fact act on behalf of DePaul. Nothing in the faculty handbook states that Faculty Council has power to make any decisions related to any other faculty member's employment or to sanction or discipline a faculty member in any way. And as the lower court correctly held, there were no actions that constituted a sanction in this particular case. Also, there were no damages, as this was discussed during counsel's first argument. Dr. Hill has only alleged potential future damages, which are speculative in nature. The bottom line is that Dr. Hill was not censured, nor was his speech chilled. He still continues to take advantage of the right to publish on these matters. The second violation, as we understand it, of the faculty handbook is a violation of section 1.3.6, which requires all decisions and recommendations of the faculty council to be forwarded to the provost or president for approval. I'm sorry.
Your assertion that the damages, all of his damages are speculative, would apply to every allegation of breach in the contract, would they not?
That is correct.
Okay, go ahead.
So as I mentioned, section 1.3.6 requires all decisions and recommendations to go to the president and provost for approval and for them to take certain action. There can be no question that the Faculty Council resolution on academic freedom and responsibility is not a decision and it's not a recommendation. It neither calls for any action to be taken, nor did it require any action to be taken. As we know, the provost acknowledged the resolution and moved on with her day. So there can't be a violation of this section since nothing was required of the administration in response to the resolution. The third allegation of breach of contract, again, as we understand the third amended complaint, relates to section 4.4 of the handbook. And that section states that disciplinary proceedings are reserved for situations that warrant the imposition of a major or minor sanction by the dean and or the provost. In this case, there are no allegations that the dean or the provost imposed any form of sanction against Dr. Hill that would have warranted a disciplinary proceeding. Criticisms of the opinions expressed in his article doesn't count as a sanction. Dr. Hill suffered no discipline as a result of the article, and his convoluted breach of contract claim on this point is essentially that DePaul breached the faculty handbook by not putting him through a disciplinary process, by not bringing charges against him, and by not conducting formal proceedings to strip him of his tenure or to terminate his employment. The reality is, had DePaul actually disciplined him for expressing his opinions, he may have had a meritorious breach of contract claim, but he doesn't have one. Accordingly, we ask that you affirm the lower court's dismissal of the breach of contract claims in count one of the third amended complaint. Count two, as you know, is for defamation per se against Dr. Pei and DePaul, as best we understand it. Again, there are some issues here. As well as we can tell, there are three purported statements that are considered to be defamatory by Dr. Hill. The first are generally purported statements made at the faculty council meeting. Now, the third amended complaint doesn't clearly identify any such statements, and there's no reference in appellant's brief to any such statements. Therefore, we don't believe those are properly before the court. The second alleged defamatory statement is Dr. Ghanem's May 15th, 2019 email to the university community. The third amended complaint doesn't clearly allege that Dr. Ghanem's email was defamatory. In fact, those allegations were dismissed with prejudice, were not properly preserved, and are not subject to this appeal. There's no argument in appellant's opening brief about why the email is defamatory, and we believe that argument is waived. At best, the third amended complaint and appellant's reply brief allege that Dr. Ghanem's email was an endorsement or a ratification of the resolution, but her email didn't even reference the resolution. Rather, her email expresses the provost's opinions that she was deeply saddened that Professor Hill used his right to academic freedom and free speech to disparage one group over the other. Dr. Ghanem's opinions are non-actionable and cannot form the basis of a defamation claim. The third and probably most important argument here is the alleged defamatory nature of the Faculty Council resolution. Now, first, the resolution is not a statement made by Dr. Pate, nor is it a statement made by DePaul University. It's a statement by the Faculty Council, a group of the faculty. They don't speak for the university. The lower court correctly held that the Third Amendment complaint does not allege that DePaul, Pate, or Ghanem made any statements, only that Faculty Council passed a resolution. Plaintiff did not allege in this case that DePaul sufficiently controlled the actions of Faculty Council in order to be liable for Faculty Council's conduct in passing the resolution. Again, I went through the elements of agency and they're not properly pled in this case. Moreover, the Faculty Council resolution is capable of innocent construction. The resolution was critical of Jason Hill and disagreed with his views, but did not impute that he could not perform his profession as a faculty member and did not call for his removal. The resolution is also non-actionable opinion. When courts determine this, they look at whether the statement has a precise and readily understood meaning, whether the statement is verifiable, and whether the statement's literary or social context signals that it has factual content. As Justice Hoffman pointed out, by and large, the statements included in the Faculty Council resolution are not verifiable. And I submit to you that the social context of the document itself signals that it is in response to Dr. Hill's opinion in the Federalist. It is an opinion about his opinions, and it's an opinion by a group of his peers. It's not an opinion by DePaul University, and it's not an opinion directly attributed to Dr. Pate. As the lower court correctly pointed out.
What about the statement that it's factually inaccurate?
Well,
That could be verified, could it not?
Well, I think that academics debate about history all the time. And a large part of Dr. Hill's article is talking about what happened in history. And I don't think it's necessarily factually verifiable, because while we have excerpts of things that have happened over the years and in ancient history, we don't know for sure. So I think most of what history teaches us can be debated and is not necessarily verifiable. As the lower court correctly pointed out, the Faculty Council resolution is a strong statement of opinion about plaintiff's advocacy. It's not about his actions. It's an opinion about his opinions. As we know from Illinois and Seventh Circuit case law, name calling is not actionable. Calling someone a racist is not verifiable. These are not actionable things. And I think that the statements in the Faculty Council resolution need to be examined in light of the entire document, which is clearly an affirmation of academic freedom, an affirmation of First Amendment rights, but a disagreement with the way in which Dr. Hill used his right to academic freedom and First Amendment to espouse his opinions. For these reasons, we'd ask that you affirm the dismissal of count two in plaintiff's third amended complaint. With regard to count three, which is the tortious interference with prospective economic advantage against all defendants in this matter, the elements here are the existence of a valid business relationship or expectancy, the defendant's knowledge of plaintiff's relationship or expectancy, an intentional and unjustified interference by the defendant, inducing or causing a breach or termination of the expectancy, and damages to plaintiff resulting from such interference. Now, again, as we understand it, there are two claims that fall in this count. And the first is interference with the employment relationship with DePaul. The second would be interference with plaintiff's relationships with other institutions or publications outside of DePaul for which he could receive income. Now, as Justice Hoffman pointed out, the case law couldn't be clearer that DePaul cannot interfere with its own contract with Dr. Hill. And Dr. Hill has not alleged that Drs. Paith or Ghana acted solely for their personal gain or contrary to the best interest of DePaul in any actions they took. With regard to outside opportunities, Dr. Hill has not alleged that the statement by faculty counsel was a statement by DePaul, Paith, or Ghanem, and he failed to allege that any of the defendants induced a third party to terminate its contract with him. Again, Drs. Paith and Ghanem must have acted intentionally and with the purpose of injuring plaintiff's expectancy, not merely that they had a consequential impact on his opportunities. There are no allegations that the defendants knew of plaintiff's relationship with any of these entities for publications or speaking engagements.
Are you sure of that? My reading of the Third Amended complaint says that DePaul and people at DePaul were well aware of his outside opportunities that he had had in the past. And there's also, I believe, an allegation in the complaint that says they purposefully interfered with it, intending to damage it, unless I misread this complaint.
Your Honor, we believe that's conclusory. I mean, he doesn't specifically state any knowledge of any specific opportunity that was infringed upon. And even if we were to believe that the defendants had knowledge of these expectancies, these speculative future opportunities, he can't prove his damages. So he cannot meet the elements of this case. That any damages that he may receive in the future as a result of unknown expectancies is wholly.
I may address you to paragraph 120 of the complaint under interference. As alleged above, the defendants knew of Dr. Hill's professional relationship with academic institutions and publications outside of DePaul, and they're, by the way, defined in a prior paragraph. Knew that he regularly received remunerations for his work within those institutions and publications before the spring of 2019. Because of their animus, however, coming at the head of spring 19, the defendants set out to ruin his reputation and in so doing abort his relationship with institutions and publications. So there is an allegation in here they knew about it, and there's further allegation in here that they did it intentionally.
But, Your Honor, I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to point out that there's still no allegation that Dr. Paith or Dr. Ghanem acted solely for their own personal benefit or contrary to the best interests of
the Well, that's different. That argument is a good argument as it relates to the ability to interfere with their employer's perspective relationships with Dr. Hill. No question about that. That falls almost under the same exemption as the employer cannot interfere with its own perspective contracts or relationships. But is that true as to the third parties?
Arguably, we believe that these allegations are conclusory. He doesn't identify any specific relationships, any publications, any opportunities that were infringed upon. In addition to that, even if he could make out the element of purposeful interference, he still can't make out the element of damages. And therefore, we ask that you affirm the lower court's dismissal of count 3 of plaintiff's Third Amended complaint. And now I will move on to count four, which is a violation of the Illinois Human Rights Act related to race, color, ethnicity, and sexual orientation against DePaul University.
Can I back up for 1 second? On your argument is his inability to plead damages for prospective interference with prospective advantage. Are you relying almost exclusively on Anderson? I mean, is that the basis of your argument? Oh, don't take the time to look at it. I'll look at it later. Never mind.
I apologize. I think that the defendant, that plaintiff's complaint is lacking in various respects in that regard, but mostly, and I think we can hang our hat on the fact that he has not sufficiently alleged damages, only speculative damages in nature.
Okay. All right.
And I will move on, as I mentioned, to the violations of the Illinois Human Rights Act that are alleged against DePaul University. This requires Dr. Hill to demonstrate that he's a member of a protected class, that he was meeting his employer's legitimate expectations, that he suffered an adverse action, and that similarly situated employees outside the protected class were treated more favorably. Now, for purposes of the arguments way back when we argued for dismissal of the Third Amendment complaint, we took the fact that he's a member of a protected class and that he was meeting his employer's legitimate job expectations as given. We don't necessarily agree that he's continued to meet his employer's legitimate job expectations. We also don't think that by failing to indicate when he was publishing his article that he was publishing for his own personal opinions and not on behalf of DePaul University. We don't think that that was meeting his employer's legitimate job expectations. But well,
isn't really the issue on this count whether he suffered a materially adverse employment action?
Yes, Your Honor. We think he failed to plead that he suffered an adverse action, and he's failed to demonstrate that similarly situated employees outside the protected class were treated more favorably. And I can go through each of those points. There was no material adverse action here. Oral and written reprimands do not constitute an adverse action. Jason Hill did not plead any material change to the terms and conditions of his employment. There's been no reduction in his pay or no diminution in his job responsibilities. Speculative adverse action is not adverse action. The resolution was an action by his peers and not an action by DePaul University. Students held protests, distributed leaflets, held a dinner, and refused to take his courses. The students speak for the students. They don't speak for DePaul University, and their actions can't be attributed to the terms and conditions of his employment. In addition to that, we would argue that there are no similarly situated faculty members because no other faculty drafted an article stating the things that Dr. Hill stated and attributing himself as a professor of DePaul University. Therefore, he can't keep comparing apples to oranges if he's trying to point out, you know, other faculty member published things, but they weren't subject to a resolution and they were not subject to student protests. As a result, we request that this court affirm the lower court's dismissal of counts 1 through 4 of Dr. Hill's Third Amendment complaint.
As the count four, would he be required to plead that other faculty members published the same opinions that he published and they were not subject to condemnation? Or is he merely required to plead that no other faculty member who has published any opinion has ever been the subject of a condemnation resolution by the faculty council?
Your Honor, I think similarly situated would require at a minimum him to point out a very controversial opinion that was published by a faculty member that caused backlash in the community and didn't result in a faculty council resolution. Okay. Faculty members publish all sorts of things all the time. And just because a faculty member publishes, that doesn't make him similarly situated to Dr. Hill in this particular case and for purposes of allegations in count four. Thank you.
Any other questions from the panel? Thank you. And if you would like to respond, you may go ahead, Ms. Faison.
Okay, great. Thank you. Your Honors, when there is a dismissal with prejudice under 2615, the question is not what did the plaintiff allege, but rather what could they allege? And is there any set of fact that could entitle the plaintiff to relief? There is no cap in the Code of Civil Procedure on the amount of amendments to the pleadings, but rather pleadings should be liberally construed and amendments should be liberally granted to effectuate justice between the parties. Additionally, throughout the Paul's argument, they make several different factual arguments that are inappropriate for purposes of a motion to dismiss under 2615. And whenever they try to allege that there was conclusory statements and everything else, but for purposes of a 2615, the statements that are well pled must be alleged as true. And as for the whole statement about the, even assuming the resolution didn't have an action, here there was a resolution that was taken. What was the purpose of the resolution? Sure, there was no specific action at that point, but the damage was done. The precedent was set. It was step one of step two to start removing his tenure. It was a prior restraint for him. It was told, you know, if you keep publishing these quote unquote controversial articles, even though it's an op-ed piece, and even though you have academic freedom, there are going to be consequences. There was a purpose to it. It wasn't just to voice their opinions. There was a reason behind it. If it was to voice their opinions in a matter of some sort of academic discourse setting, they could have went to a coffee shop and had, you know, that same sort of peaceful interaction. But no, this was written, this was premeditated, this was deliberate, and had statements that were inflammatory, that were false, that were injurious, and that denigrated him in the eyes of the community. Additionally, let's talk about the Illinois Human Rights Count. There doesn't always have to be a comparator, especially when, as alleged here, he is the only African-American in the philosophy department. He is the only person that is a homosexual in the philosophy department at that time. He made several different statements and pleas for help that were showing, I am subject to a hostile work environment. I am getting death threats. I have to have campus walking me back. I have to get the security for the campus to walk me back. This has to proceed for 2 weeks. Students are boycotting against me. But also, let's talk about the boycotts for a second. DePaul gave the students a place that was a DePaul University-owned building to effectuate those boycotts. They didn't investigate the death threats that were presumably at this point, as alleged in the Third Amendment complaint, coming from a DePaul student or faculty member. Again, we haven't had the courtesy or luxury of having discovery in this matter, which would definitely illuminate a lot of these issues. And, you know, the points that Ms. Bozard brought up are great for summary judgment, but not a 2615 motion. And lastly, I'd like to direct the court to a case that would be considered persuasive authority, and that would be Lavallee versus the Village of Melrose Park, where the court held that a material alteration of his employment occurred and it did not require a comparator. And that citation is 734 F.
Ma'am, is it in your
brief?
It is
not, Your Honor. It is not.
Then the proper method would be to file a motion to cite additional authority. Because arguing that case in your rebuttal deprives your opponent of the ability to address it. And that's almost like checking and raising in a card game. It's just not done.
Okay. Understood, Your Honor, and I will definitely make sure and make a note of that. But in conclusion, and as we stated, at the pleading stage, the question is not, did he allege, or rather, could he allege, or is there any set of fact that would not allow him to allege? And as we stated before, and as we stated in our brief, there is a set of facts he can recover from. And there's a lot more than meets the surface of this complaint, and discovery will definitely help us guide those forces. And we ask that this court grant us a remand back to state court. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions from the panel? I thank both counsel.
Well argued by both sides. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, I thank both of you for your presentation. Yes. And the case will be taken under advisement. Thank you.
Thank you.